Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro lauds Tehran's support for Caracas despite U.S. sanctions and threats, and the two countries will sign a 20-year cooperation roadmap during his visit. Iran's foreign minister condemns Israel's attacks against Syria as a violation of the country's sovereignty and international law. And Lebanon slams the presence of an Israeli drilling vessel in its disputed waters, calling it a violation of its sovereignty and clear act of aggression. Hello, everybody, and warm welcome to World News. Our top story, Venezuelan president who is visiting Iran says that Tehran and Caracas are on the forefront of the fight against colonialism and imperialism. Nicolas Maduro made the remark in an exclusive interview with Iran's Spanish-language news channel, Hispan TV. Maduro also said his country will sign a 20-year cooperation plan with Iran. He announced the opening of a weekly flight from Caracas to Tehran. He added, the two countries have supported one another in hard times. He said it's indeed courageous of Iran to send oil to Venezuela despite U.S. sanctions and threats. Maduro also spoke about the Palestinian cause, calling it humanity's most sacred struggle right now. The Venezuelan president arrived in Tehran Friday for a two-day visit. Author and journalist Arnold August joined us earlier to explain why the Venezuelan president's visit to Iran is significant.
During the height of the American sanctions against Venezuela, the Iranian government courageously sent several tankers over a period of 1 or 2 years in order to assist the Venezuelan oil industry to kickstart itself. So this is just what is happening today, is a continuation of this extremely important bilateral relations between Venezuela and Iran. I think it has, you know, there's a lot of important points. I could not just today regarding this summit in the of the Americas. Daniel Ortega, representing the Nicaragua government, said in his country what many people perhaps were thinking but not say out aloud, as he did. And he said one of the reasons that Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua were excluded from the summit by the United States was as a result of these three countries, their close ties with Russia in the current situation. I guess indirectly it's also because of how these three countries together are working in order to try to push against U.S. hegemony in this very important period of world history.
Iran has strongly condemned the latest Israeli missile strikes on the Syrian capital, Damascus, vowing to stand by the country's government and people. Iran's foreign minister said that Israeli attacks against Syrian infrastructure are illegal under international law and violate the country's sovereignty and territory. Hossein Amir Abdullahian also says the silence of the international community and regional organizations on the issue is regrettable and shameful. He made the comments in a phone call with a Syrian counterpart. Faisal Miqdad also said Israel's hasty acts of aggression are a sign of its fear and weakness. Miqdad said the regime vainly seeks to prop up remnants of terror groups in Syria. He said, however, the Israeli attacks strengthen the resolve of the Syrian government and nation to fight occupation and terrorism. Members of the MKO terrorist group attacked for a second day an exhibition held in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, on crimes committed by the group. MKO agents tried to stop the event by ripping down banners of the exhibition. Police made some arrests. Organizers, though, said the police refused to provide better security for the event despite vandalism by MKO members. Agents of the terrorist cult mobbed the exhibition Thursday as well, tearing down banners and splashing paint everywhere. They violently assaulted a reporter and accompanying Press TV news team, as well as other participants. A notorious group launched a campaign of bombings and assassinations in Iran, mostly throughout the 1980s. It is currently based out of Albania, where it enjoys freedom of activity. And we asked some Swedish citizens what they made of MKO and its crimes.
it's really amazing that they are using that they used the former Iraq weaponry and so on against their own people. It's like a civil war, and it's of course it's a principle of treason against your own country, obviously, regardless of what kind of ideology or policy you want to make within the country. To do things like that is it's against the principle of you have an obligation to your own country, regardless on what are your personal political beliefs.
If a bunch of Swedish people, they go to your enemy country and attack back your country and your people by all kind of crimes, what would you think about them?
Yeah, well, that obviously is treacherous behavior. It wouldn't be good. But I believe that Sweden already today are run by traitors. So at the moment, there is not much to defend.
You know those people, they are standing here. What would you call them if they was a Swedish people that help your enemy to attack back your country?
Enemy against their own people.
Would you let them to control your country as your government?
No, never.
Would you call them your people anymore?
No, because they have made a choice. They are not with my people then. Exactly like it is for you now. They take a stand against their own people.
Your audience have gathered in Tehran to mark the auspicious occasion of the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, 8th infallible Imam of the Shia household. Iranians seized the opportunity to condemn France for awarding a movie which insulted Imam Reza during the Cannes Film Festival almost 10 days ago. Saman Kujuri has your story.
Thousands of Iranian Muslims have come together in capital Tehran to celebrate the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, the 8th infallible Shia Imam. People from different walks of life took part in the ceremony to pay respect to the lofty status of Imam Reza, who is considered by Iranians as a symbol of divine love and affection.
I'm here to say that we love Imam Reza from the bottom of our hearts. I have raised my children with a love for Imam Reza. We are ready to die for him, and we will continue his path.
The ceremony comes almost 10 days after France awarded a movie titled Holy Spider during the Cannes Film Festival, which Muslims believed insulted Islamic sanctities.
Iranian officials believe that awarding the movie Holy Spider is insulting and politically motivated and is the product of the confused mind of a Danish-Iranian filmmaker, sponsored and financed by global arrogance.
People strongly condemn the move by France, saying such a sacrilegious act will never be forgotten.
I want to send this message to the enemies that the light of the sun will never fade away. So the name and the path of Imam Reza will remain forever, and the enemies' plots will never bear any results.
I believe that awarding the movie Holy Spider has been totally politically motivated, and it was an open insult to Islamic sanctities. We condemn such a movie, and we condemn such a sacrilegious act against Islam.
The participants believe that the large gathering of Muslim believers has sent this message to the enemies of Islam, that Muslims will never remain silent and indifferent towards any insult against their sanctities, and they are ready to defend their Islamic values and beliefs until the last drop of their blood. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
People across Iran have joined Muslims in other countries to condemn blasphemous remarks by two Indian ruling party officials against the Holy Prophet Muhammad.
Insulting our beliefs, our imams, our country, and our values, we stand against anyone who insults us.
A centerpiece of protests was a gathering outside the main campus of the University of Tehran. There, protesters held banners and chanted slogans denouncing the sacrilegious comments about the Prophet's private life. India's ruling party has suspended one of the officials behind the insults and has expelled the other, insisting it respects all religions. but that has not calmed the protests both in the country and abroad. On Friday, demonstrations were held in Pakistan's Lahore demanding the government take stronger action against India.
The government should have boycotted all Indian products. There needs to be a response to India in a way that the future generations will also know that a line is crossed when the Muslim's prophet is insulted.
In India, Muslims staged demonstrations in many areas, including New Delhi, to call for punishment of the officials. Clashes erupted with police in at least two cities. Authorities also shut down the internet in the Indian-administered Kashmir and declared a curfew, while also banning all congressional prayers at mosques. Similar protests were held in Bangladesh, Indonesia, and other Muslim countries.
In the Muslim-majority Indian-administered Kashmir, people observed a shutdown to denounce the derogatory remarks by two members of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against Prophet Muhammad. After condemnations by the global Muslim community, the two were suspended. Despite strict security arrangements, people in the summer capital, Srinagar, took to the streets, saying they have tolerated everything so far, but nothing against their beloved prophet.
We demand stringent punishment against these culprits. No religion teaches intolerance. What we see growing attacks on Muslims and their emotions in India now.
These two people have dented the image of Hinduism on the global forum by speaking against the prophet of Islam. Scores of Muslim countries are today upset about India and its behavior towards minority Muslims. We have tolerated a lot, be it scraping of Article 370 or delimitation, but this time it's about our beloved prophet. We'll take to the streets without fearing any consequences.
In Srinagar, mobile internet services were suspended as a precautionary measure to avoid the snowballing of protests. Government forces were seen deployed in strength while people closed down businesses, shops and other activities. Last week, BJP suspended its national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, who made anti-Islam remarks on a TV debate last month. Also, Naveen Kumar Jindal was expelled from the party over his blasphemous tweets about the Prophet Muhammad. The controversial remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, have sparked global outrage against India. The Muslim community across the world is denouncing the growing anti-Muslim ideology and hate crimes against the minorities in the country. They're accusing BJP of backing anti-Muslim ideology in what they call once a secular India. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Lebanon says the presence of an Israeli drilling platform in disputed waters is a violation of the country's sovereignty and a clear act of aggression. The comments were made by head of Lebanon's technical military delegation in maritime border negotiations with the Israeli regime. In an interview with Iran's Al-Alam News Network, Bassam Yassin said Lebanon had been monitoring the Israeli ship since it left Singapore and until it reached Palestinian waters. Israeli floating gas production unit arrived in the disputed maritime zone between Israel and Lebanon over the weekend. It prompted furious reactions from the Lebanese government, with Prime Minister Najib Mikati warning of an escalation. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah also says it is ready to take action, including use of force against Israeli gas operations. Lebanon and Israel, which have no diplomatic ties, have been holding indirect talks brokered by the U.S. for close to 2 years to resolve a maritime border dispute. Fallout from the Russia-Ukraine war continues to take a heavy toll on the U.S. economy. U.S. stocks fall sharply as the country's inflation surges to a new four-decade high. New York Stock Exchange saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the broad-based S&P 500, and the tech-rich NASDAQ Composite Index all tumble. It came after the Labor Department said the consumer price index surged by over 8.6% in May compared to the same period last year, which is unseen since 1981. Now, this figure exceeded all forecasts, and it comes as gasoline prices are hitting record highs every day in America as the war in Ukraine drags on. Prices also continued to rise last month for a range of other goods, including housing, groceries, airline fares, and vehicles. European Central Bank has confirmed its intention to hike interest rates at a policy meeting next month. The move is aimed at trying to bring down soaring prices throughout the Eurozone. Jerome Hughes reports out of Brussels.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by 0.25% next month, most likely 0.5% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, the cost of living is high already, and then so if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, calculate like exactly what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court.
It's a discussion that I've had also with our US colleagues. We are on the same line to try to see what is possible to do. But you know that we try to promote the rule of law.
Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics say Western powers were wrong not to listen to Moscow's security concerns as they built up military capabilities close to Russia's borders and refused to rule out Ukraine joining NATO. ECB bosses are due to meet again to discuss the financial crisis on the 21st of July. Many are asking if the EU's focus stays on arming Ukraine and not conflict resolution, how can things possibly improve between now and then? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thank you for joining in and bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Victims of gun crime in the United States are following an alternative path forged by legal actions against cigarette makers, prescription opioid manufacturers, and big oil in an attempt to work around Protection of Law, Commerce in Arms Act, or PLCAA, and the lack of political will to act on gun control to hold the firearms industry accountable for the bloody toll of its products. We have prepared for you an article written by Chris McGreal. The piece is titled, Gun Crime Victims Are Holding the US Firearms Industry Accountable by Taking Them to Court. With each slaughter of innocents, the gun industry offers its sympathy, argues that even more weapons will make America safer, and gives thanks for a two-decade-old law shielding the firearms makers from legal action by the victims. Mike Pfeiffer, the chief executive of one of America's leading handgun manufacturers, Sturm Ruger, once described the 2005 Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, or PLCAA, as having saved the firearms industry because it stopped in its tracks a wave of lawsuits over the reckless marketing and sales of guns. But now victims of gun crime are following an alternative path forged by legal action against cigarette makers, prescription opioid manufacturers and big oil, in an attempt to work around the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, or PLCAA, and a lack of political will to act on gun control, to hold the firearms industry accountable for the bloody toll of its products. On Tuesday, 7th of June, Eileen Stewart, who was badly injured when a man fired 33 shots on New York subway in April, wounding 10 people, filed a lawsuit accusing the manufacturer of the semi-automatic pistol used in the attack, a Glock, of breaching public nuisance laws. Eileen Stewart's lawsuit contends that Glock endangered public health and safety in breach of New York state law with an irresponsible marketing campaign to push its guns' high capacity and ease of concealment in an appeal to prospective purchasers with criminal intent. It also accuses gun manufacturer Glock of giving significant discounts to American police departments on weapons purchases to give the gun credibility in the larger and more lucrative civilian market. Mark Sherian, Eileen Stewart's lawyer, said, "Gun manufacturers do not live in a bubble. They are aware that their marketing strategies are empowering purchasers with ill intent and endangering the lives of innocent people. This lawsuit seeks to hold the gun industry accountable. The public nuisance strategy has been used against the tobacco industry for lying about the link between cigarettes and lung cancer, and with mixed success against pharmaceutical companies for creating the US opioid epidemic by recklessly pushing prescription opioids. Public nuisance claims are also at the heart of a series of lawsuits by states and municipalities, accusing oil firms of covering up and lying about the part fossil fuels play in driving the climate crisis. Until recently, the gun industry thought that PLCAA provided a shield from similar actions. The National Rifle Association, NRA, persuaded a Republican-controlled Congress to pass the law after the families of people shot by the sniper who terrorized the Washington, D.C. area for 3 weeks in 2002, killing 10 people, won a total of $2.5 million from the gun manufacturer Bushmaster and the store that sold the weapon. But a lawsuit by the families of 20 young children and six staff murdered in the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre sought to exploit an exception in PLCAA if a firearm is sold in violation of applicable state or federal laws, in this case, public nuisance and consumer protection legislation. Connecticut Supreme Court upheld the argument that the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, PLCAA, did not prevent the gunmaker being sued for breach of state laws for irresponsibly militaristic marketing campaigns for its semi-automatic rifles aimed at young men. Remington Arms Company appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which declined to take the case while it was still in litigation. In February, Remington settled for $73 million. At about the time the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Sandy Hook families, New York introduced the law Eileen Stewart is relying on that expands public nuisance legislation to cover gun crimes. Recently, a federal district judge in New York dismissed an attempt by the gun industry to quash the law on the grounds that it preempted the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, or PLCAA. Timothy Litton, a specialist in gun litigation at Georgia State University College of Law and author of Suing the Gun Industry, expects the validity of the New York law and the claim that public nuisance legislation is an exception to the protection given to the gun industry to be appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. He said, "The most important thing that the U.S. Supreme Court needs to decide with regards to firearms litigation is probably the scope of the federal immunity law and whether or not the exception that was relied upon by the Sandy Hook plaintiffs is a viable legal theory. If it's a viable legal theory, then I think you're likely to see an upsurge in litigation." But Litton said legal action against the gun industry face an additional challenge because of the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Second Amendment and the rights it gives to gun owners, a legal area that has also yet to be more widely tested. He said, "There are limits on the ability to sue a newspaper for libel because of the First Amendment. It may be the case that the Second Amendment has similar restrictions on the ability of individuals to hold the firearms manufacturers liable. But we don't know what those restrictions might be because we have very little indication from the Supreme Court about what the Second Amendment actually protects, other than a basic right for an individual to own a firearm that they can use for ordinary purposes." Still, as litigation against the tobacco, opioid and oil industry demonstrates, the point of lawsuits is not only to win in court. After each massacre, the gun industry usually seeks to blame the individual shooter and a failure of systems such as mental health services. Litton said lawsuits put the focus back on the actions of the firearms makers and forces public discussion of how they sell their weapons.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider, bringing you back to reality. Here in the studio today, we have with us dear sister Zainab Sadat. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And our dear brother, Sheikh Yasir Ibrahim. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Now, obviously, faith is a central part of Islam. Alladhina amanu wa amilu salihat, those who believe and do good deeds. This phrase is repeated so often throughout the Quranic literature, the tafasir, and even in the Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam's words. We know that these two things, belief and good deeds, are incredibly, incredibly important. But we're going to be focusing on the first part of that, this idea of iman. Why is it so important? I mean, I can give charity, I can be a good person to others. Why do I have to have this belief? I'd like to go first to Sheikh Ibrahim.
It's a very important question. Again, it's a theological question. I don't want to bore the listeners with my theological rants. But why is belief important? Just be, like you mentioned, be a good person. You know, one of the things that belief gives you is a kind of border, right? Like, for example, everybody has belief. First of all, there's something to get in there. Mm. Nobody can say, "Oh, I have no belief." Having no belief yourself is a belief, right?
Yeah.
So whatever your belief may be, you act according to it. It's a manifestation. Your actions are manifestation of what you have inside of you.
It's like when somebody says, I have no politics.
Exactly. And that's itself is a political stance, right?
It's a political stance.
The same thing. Yeah. The belief that you have, again, how you get that belief, how you've ended up coming to that particular conclusion that this is what I believe in. I believe in aliens, for example, and aliens are going to come and induct me or whatever you want to do. You have gone through a particular journey to reach that particular conclusion. And then you will act with the world around you based on those beliefs, right? So first of all, principally, the beliefs or your actions rather are a manifestation of your beliefs. So therefore, they are important, regardless whether you like it or not. Interacting with other people, therefore, are also based on your beliefs. Further, the reason why you interact with people, your intentions are based on your beliefs. The intention, the actual intention that you
have. Right.
So it whole spectrum of things. So it is important for a person to clearly identify, what do I believe in?
Mm.
In order to understand, okay, well, this is why I'm acting in a particular manner. Or this is why I shouldn't act in a particular manner. Like, for example, in Western society, or in majority of societies throughout the world, people don't commit crime not because, I'm being watched by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there's a CCTV camera watching.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The big difference, right? Remove the camera.
To quote the Joker, when the chips are down, these civilized people, they will eat each other.
Proper.
You know, because when the electricity goes, for example, the CCTV cameras are switched off, now all hell breaks loose. It's a good point. So your beliefs directly impact your actions.
We'll come right back to that, inshallah, after a break.
Sister, what are your immediate thoughts on this idea of faith being so important?
Well, I personally believe that faith is somehow a pillar to a person. It is considered as the pillar of a person, the base of a person. When I have a good thoughts, when I have good beliefs about here in religion, about God, for example, I will not be influenced by anything or any person at all, you know. In case I don't have a much strong belief, in case I'm just imitating my parents, for example, in doing religious conducts, then somebody comes to me and tells me that, okay, Zainab, you don't have to bother yourself. Mm. You can just eat your food when you're alone. And when you come to your parents, you can pretend to be fasting. Mm. Or you can pretend to say your prayers in front of them and lots of things. But, you know, when it comes to me and I have a good belief or faith, I would say no. I would say strongly no.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that God watches me. And I believe that fasting is good for my health. It's good for my own. I do not want to cheat others. I cannot cheat myself. And that's the case. So it's quite important for everyone to work on their beliefs or to work on their faith, because it shows lots of things and it determines your destiny and your and even your relationship to God.
Right. Okay, so what I'm getting from both of you here is that faith is important because it influences your actions, right? I am a decent human being. And some of them, you know, in action-wise, they are. You know, they even if the lights were switched off, per se, a certain person, they wouldn't commit any crimes. They wouldn't be dishonest. They wouldn't steal anything. They wouldn't kill anybody, right? Even though they don't have any faith at all in, like, a higher power. So what do you have to say about that?
That particular post, obviously we cannot look at specifics. Looking at specifics would obviously be detrimental. We have to understand that, okay, is my faith important, or is there a particular faith that I have to accept that will make all of this worthy?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, otherwise it would just be one action.
For example, people ask questions that Thomas Edison, like today,
the light bulb, the
microphone we're using, the lights we're in, our laptops, our phones, everything is based off that one discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so much good is done from it. What happened to this person? But we do not know Thomas Edison, the person. We don't know what he did. We don't know what he may have done, other things in his private life. We don't know. We know nothing. History doesn't tell us anything. So we can't make specifics about these people. We don't know what's in a person's heart.
Hmm.
We don't know the intentions of that person. Which comes back to a more important thing. Like I mentioned as well, the concept of intention. We have, the concept of faith. The intention by which the action is done is also important.
Hmm.
Do I do that action in order to become famous?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where you find a difference. For example, one of the great scholars of Islam, Shaykh Mutahhari, rahmatullah alayhi, writes in one of his books that there was a time when nobody would work in a certain hospital in Iran. And a group of Christians from the Europe came. So he said, look, not to be pessimistic and not to be negative, but let's look at why they came. Did they come purely out of altruism, just to come and serve, or was there something behind them? This is something we need to look at. The intention here is important.
They were being paid. Yeah.
Or whatever it was, right? So is the act itself important or no? Is the intention behind that act also important? And belief forms that intention.
So are we saying that a person who doesn't have the faith but has the action is actually in some ways insincere in what they do?
Depending on what they're looking at. Why are you doing it? And one of the beauties of this world is that you will never know a person's intention.
It's not a beautiful thing, isn't it? It's a little bit frustrating. Let's come back to Sister. You said a very adamant yes there.
Yes, and another thing that sets an atheist person or a person who does not have any belief in God with a person who is Muslim or believes in God is the criteria that are set by God, and we have to follow them. I accepted that our instincts tell us what to do, and definitely a good thing is considered as a good thing for all the religions. For example,
to an extent.
Yes, for example, being kind, it is considered as a good thing for everybody. And coming to Islam, God has set some criteria for being good, for treating other people in a good way. And there are several narrations, there are several verses, and I think that we don't have much time. In general, I want to say that the criteria that are set by our God, Allah, or by Islam, make it different for us to act from those who do not believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's it.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Al-a'mal bin niyat, that your actions are based on your intention. But then the imam goes, wa huwa al-amal, that the intention itself is the act. Like the imam goes deeper. He doesn't say that your actions are based on your intention. The imam stops and says, no. Mm. Think about it. Your act, the intention itself is your act.
That is subhanallah. Subhanallah.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam mentioned this tradition that the intention itself is the actual manifestation of the act, and the output of that intention of yours is what you see in the physical.
So when it comes to the... actions are on niyat, on the intentions, right? So actions matter only according to what the intention behind them was. That's what we're essentially saying here. And if the imam is actually defining the intention itself, to make an intention is a verb. It is a action that we're taking. What's the niyyah behind that?
That is goes back to irada. It goes back to will.
Goes back to what?
Will. The will of the soul.
We're talking about, you know, as'alukum ala ruh. Like, they ask you concerning the ruh. And then Allah replies, well, he tells the Prophet to say, قُلِ الرُّوح
مِنْ أَمْرِ اللَّهِ أَمْرِ رَبِّكِ
أَمْرِ رَبِّكِ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. So that's really deeply philosophical, isn't it? Because that means that your action of having an intention, the intention behind that action is God.
Is the reason why we're doing. Intention could be somehow regarded as the reason for why you're doing something.
This is where you see the difference. The concept of ruh and nafs is very difficult. But there are certain faculties within the nafs. Each of these faculties manifests a certain thing. Your nafs can have an intention that can be satanic, and it can be divine. So you see the intention, wherever it flows from, will manifest itself very differently. Even though in the physical manner it may be the same in terms of its outward appearance, but its source is very different. For example, a person like, let's mention his name, Mr. Musk, may give charity, but for a very devilish intention. Give a lot of money, but for a very devilish intention. Whereas me or you give not even a 0.001% of that same thing. And there's a very famous thing about the khums. I don't know if you remember the story of the khums.
If you can throw it in there
very quickly. I can't remember which imam it was. I think it was Imam Kazim alayhi salam, if I'm not mistaken, that all of his Shia from all over, I think it was from Khorasan, give khums. Imam said, take all of his back. There's one coin. Give me that coin. One coin. Why? He said, this was done with ikhlas. The rest was not. It was from a lady who gave one coin.
That's all we have time for, unfortunately. I wish we could discuss this in more detail. From myself, from Sister Zainab Sadat, and from Brother Yasser Ibrahim, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In a rare convergence, America's voters are not merely unhappy with their political leadership, but awash in fears about economic security, border security, international security, and even physical security. The article you're about to hear has been written by Mark Penn, a pollster and former advisor to President Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton from 1995 to 2008. Mark Penn is the chairman of Harris Poll and CEO of Stagwell Inc. The article has been published by the New York Times. It is titled, American Voters Haven't Been Afraid Like This in a Long Time. In a rare convergence, America's voters are not merely unhappy with their political leadership, but awash in fears about economic security, border security, international security, and even physical security. Without a U-turn by the Biden administration, these fears will generate a wave election like those in 1994 and 2010, setting off a chain reaction that could flip the House and the Senate to Republican control in November, and ultimately the presidency in 2024. Take the economy, so often the harbinger of election results. From late 2017 until the pandemic, a majority of Americans believed that the economy was strong, and from 2014 until the pandemic, at least a plurality believed their personal economic situation was improving. COVID-19 cut sharply into that feeling of well-being. This was initially seen as temporary, though, and trillions of dollars flowed into keeping people afloat. But then, near double-digit inflation hit consumers for the first time in 40 years. 60% of American voters now see the economy as weak, and 48% say their financial situation is worsening, according to a Harris poll conducted on 20th and 21st of April. Many Americans under the age of 60 have relatively little experience with anything but comparatively low fuel costs, negligible interest rates, and stable prices. Virtually overnight, these assumptions have been shaken. Only 35% approve of President Joe Biden's handling of inflation. These economic blows are just one element in a cascading set of problems, all hitting at the same time. It combines the nuclear anxieties of the 1950s and 1960s with the inflation threat of the 70s, the crime wave of the 1980s and 90s, and the tensions over illegal immigration in the 2000s and beyond. This electorate is not experiencing a malaise, as President Jimmy Carter was once apocryphally said to have proclaimed, but has instead formed into a deep national fissure ready to blow like a geyser in the next election if leadership does not move to relieve the pressure. The return of fear about crime is especially worrisome for Democrats, who spent years trying to take over Republican ground on the issue. In 1991, the homicide rate was 9.71 per 100,000 of the population. Joe Biden, when he was a senator, wrote the key federal bipartisan anti-crime bill, widely credited then with reducing violence in America, but under criticism today by those who argue it led to inequitable rates of incarceration, particularly in communities of color. The homicide rate would decline to a low of 4.44 per 100,000 of the population in 2014. Worries about walking the streets and riding the subway were less acute among new generations. And yet today, those same streets and mass transit are once again hobbled by fear. Even the head of the New York Area Metropolitan Transportation Authority argued that fear of crime and homelessness was behind a 36% drop in ridership between December of 2021 and January of 2022. Immigration was used effectively by President Donald Trump as a wedge issue to win working-class voters. According to the April Harris poll, under Joe Biden, 59% of voters believe that we have effectively opened borders, and looking back, many even support some of Donald Trump's immigration policies. Joe Biden receives only 38% approval for his immigration policy, a troublingly low rating for a Democrat. President Barack Obama was at 29% approval on immigration policy before the 2000-term midterm wipeout. National security had become less salient for most Americans compared to the years of the Cold War and after 9/11. Foreign policy was barely discussed in the limited presidential debates of 2020. Today, fear of a great power conflict and nuclear weapons has emerged in ways not seen since the Cold War. With a conflict in Ukraine and fresh ballistic missile tests, fear of nuclear weapons has been thrust front and center, as a recent focus group of Americans by New York Times Opinion found out as well. Fear of nuclear weapons now ranks second in issues that worry voters, behind the effects of inflation. Combat the drag that fear has on the electorate, what I call a fear index, Joe Biden will have to move in some big and bold ways. Faced with runaway spending in the 1990s, President Bill Clinton proposed a balanced budget, a policy still favored by 80% of the electorate, according to April's Harris poll. But he did it in a way that still managed to finance entitlements like Social Security. Pushing a big seven-year policy plan like that would mean finding budget cuts elsewhere to pay for a permanent child tax credit, rather than raising taxes and deficit spending, which would most likely cause costs to fall on the average American through inflation. Balancing the budget would change the conversation about the economy and show Americans that Joe Biden was serious about getting our fiscal house in order. Continuing to let gas prices surge will hurt Democrats on the ballot in the fall. The party needs a new tempered energy policy that includes a more gradual transition to alternative fuels and an appreciation of energy independence. In the presidential debates, Joe Biden promised a transition to renewable energy over time, though noting he would not attempt to ban fracking. But in his first flurry of executive orders, Mr. Biden gave the public the impression he was far more aggressive in favouring climate change policies, though he has since angered activists by reversing a promise to prevent new drilling on public lands. He will need to shift to an all-of-the-above energy approach and greenlight the Keystone pipeline, which 65% of the electorate says should move forward, according to the Harris poll. The Biden administration is also losing in swing areas on immigration, as evidenced by the 9 Senate Democrats and the House's bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus that have expressed reservations about its plan to lift Title 42. The Trump administration's COVID-era policy of intercepting and returning migrants without due process. The answer is to keep in place the COVID-related border restrictions and revive trying to find a real compromise with at least 10 Republican senators on immigration that would adopt tougher barrier and enforcement measures to close the border, but also open up legal immigration and a path to citizenship for at least DACA recipients. With rising crime as an issue, the favorable rating of the Department of Justice has sunk to just 51% under Merrick Garland, according to the Harris poll. Joe Biden needs to shake up his top law enforcement officials and back legislation that combines police reform with funding for hundreds of thousands of new community police officers, greater federal involvement in stopping violent crime syndicates and gangs, and wider discretion for judges to take violent criminals off the streets. The Biden administration needs to consider interceding on behalf of victims in circumstances in which district attorneys are not prosecuting violent criminals to the full extent of the law, especially when they waive enhancements for gang-related crimes. One of the first campaign advertisements in 1996 established President Clinton as both against assault weapons and for more cops and crime-fighting measures. He kept that message up during his re-election bid, and Republicans never effectively stoked fears about crime. Finally, the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan precipitated a decline in Biden administration's approval rates. According to reports, Joe Biden now says he's running for re-election in 2024, but he's facing limited enthusiasm in his own party for a second run and loses even to Donald Trump in hypothetical matchups, according to the Harris poll. Sticking to the high-priced Build Back Better legislation or variants of it on the basis of narrow party line votes has not been successful. People are afraid of being walloped financially, being injured or menaced by criminals, being in a country without strong borders or COVID protections for immigrants, and being under threat of nuclear weapons. If Joe Biden and Democratic leaders cannot effectively address these fears, the wave election will hit them this November, and the president will then face a sobering choice of either passing the baton to another candidate in 2024 or finding the bold leadership necessary to reconcile his drive for more progressive policies with the realities of economics, politics, and a more dangerous world.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.